Welcome to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we aim to take you to the heart of ag policy. I'm your host, Lydia Johnson. We're bringing you a special edition of the show from the National Association of Farm Broadcasting annual convention in Kansas City. I spoke with ag industry leaders gathered to share the latest updates on issues important to farm country, like biofuels, trade, and conservation. To begin, American Coalition for Ethanol CEO Brian Jennings says he's optimistic the ample grain supply in the U.S. will put pressure on the administration and lawmakers to take long-awaited action on biofuel policy.
You know, before the government shut down, I would have told you that this expected and now record large corn crop was absolutely motivation for Congress, especially to meet the moment on E15. We already had sort of an indication from the administration side of things, what they expected to do with the RFS, and that would be very positive. But there are two items of unfinished business now, and 43 days of a government shutdown really compressed what we have remaining for legislative days in Congress. 15 approximately days in order to get all the must-pass bills done. I'm deeply concerned that Congress is not going to meet the moment, and that's a shame, because talk about creating domestic demand for domestic fuel. If E15 were the standard, we're talking north of 2 billion bushels of corn grind, which farmers desperately need right now. 6, maybe 7 billion gallons of additional ethanol demand. And so it's really critical for Congress to take this step, if not yet this year, as soon as possible in 2026. There are some must-pass bills that E15 could hitch a ride on, and it's really incumbent on Congress to take that step.
And farm country has, you know, long been pushing for year-round E15, and you mentioned, you know, meeting the moment. Congress almost did that in December last year with that stopgate spending bill. But, you know, do you think that farm country's economic and grain supply situation that's going on right now create kind of a perfect storm for Congress to include that in those must-pass bills next year, early next year?
I do. As a former Hill staffer, I know that Congress responds to crisis. And farmers might debate whether you want to call what's going on economically a crisis or not, but a lot of them feel pain they haven't felt in a very long time economically. And so you would think that's exactly the final bit of motivation Congress would need in order to get this done. And so it's remarkable to me, Lydia, that we're sitting here. You referenced a year ago we almost got this done. It's remarkable to me that we're sitting here and California unanimously adopted legislation to make E15 lawful in that state, and it was signed by Governor Newsom, yet Congress hasn't figured out how to get this legislation over the finish line.
Summit Carbon Solutions has, you know, been pushing ahead on a carbon pipeline with ample roadblocks, but they've been pushing ahead on that. I mean, what would it mean for ethanol if that pipeline is not built and doesn't get finalized?
It's going to create a division between haves and have-nots in the ethanol industry. Those who have access to a carbon pipeline are going to economically benefit significantly over their counterparts. It's that simple. It's really a shame that South Dakota essentially put up, you know, sort of a wall around the state and said you cannot build a pipeline here by virtue of the legislation that they adopted and was signed into law by the governor in South Dakota. And so now what you see, Lydia, are other states looking at doing something on their own, avoiding South Dakota altogether. Summit is still alive. There are still many ethanol plants that want to be part of it. They're looking at how they can reroute and not even go through South Dakota. You have Tallgrass, which is already hooking up ethanol plants in the state of Nebraska and shipping that CO2 for sequestration in Wyoming. Those ethanol producers, and I'm happy for them, are going to benefit enormously from the 45Q credit and other opportunities that they have through lower carbon ethanol markets. And those who do not have access to that are not going to benefit.
We'll be back with more Newsmakers right after this.
Farm Credit supports rural communities and agriculture with reliable, consistent credit and financial services in good times and bad. we provide loans to farmers and ranchers, farmer-owned cooperatives, rural homebuyers, agribusinesses, and rural infrastructure providers. As cooperatives, we're locally owned and governed. We help agricultural producers feed the world. For America's farmers, Farm Credit, supporting rural communities and agriculture. Learn more today.
Think some of sustainability to farmers just comes second nature. If you asked a farmer, are you sustainable, they'd probably look at you maybe a little funny and say, I don't think I'm doing anything that special, but it really is just what they do. We're all farmers, and our goal is taking the best care of our land, our cattle, our natural resources.
This
is my sustainability story.
Welcome back. The Trump administration recently announced increasing the beef import quota from Argentina. We asked Lance Zimmerman with Rabobank what the impact of that announcement is with the low cattle supply.
You know, there's been a lot of discussion about tighter beef supplies. And what's always really important for us to realize is cattle supplies are tighter, but beef supplies haven't started tightening yet. As we look at it, the cow herd peaked in 2019, and it's kind of bottomed out in 2025. Expectation is the next several years we're going to lean into heifer retention, lean into herd rebuilding, and we'll still be in a tight supply environment, or we'll be in an increasingly cattle supply tightening environment these next few years as we remove heifers from the beef supply chain to rebuild the cow herd. But ironically, over the last 6 years, the beef supply has been remarkably steady, between 58 and 59 pounds a person since 2020. And that kind of gets lost in the news when we talk about high beef prices, because we see the tighter cattle numbers, but per capita supplies are what really drive pricing as an economist. And so as we look at it, this discussion about imports is relevant, because as the cattle numbers have declined, there have been three main reasons per capita supplies have been able to stay steady. One is imports. We went from kind of traditionally a 20-year average around 3 billion pounds of imports a year to 2 years ago, it was over 3.5 billion pounds. Last year, it was a little over 4.5 billion pounds. And this year, it's going to be over 5 billion pounds. And so imports have been a part of that because we've needed to replace cull cow beef. We've culled less cows from the beef cow herd progressively the last few years. We've culled less dairy cows. And so imports serve a valuable role in replacing that lean beef that we need because we consume over 50% of our beef as ground beef. The other side of it, though, is carcass weight gains. In the U.S., we've added days on feed as feed costs have become cheaper and cattle numbers have dropped. That's been a huge boost in beef supplies. And then we've shifted cattle out of the dairy system that used to go into the veal production system and moved them into feed yards. And so as we look at this, as we talk about Argentina and imports in particular, there's a lot of hand-wringing around imports, and I get it. But imports, when we look at it on a per capita supply basis, are only about 18% of domestic beef consumption. 66% of our beef is consumed out of U.S. feedlots, out of our steer and heifer population. The remaining balance is out of cull cow beef. And so imports are a really small percent. And even that move to expand Argentina's quota, essentially all else equal, would only add about 0.5% to beef supplies. To put that into perspective, that's about an extra quarter pounder for every American each year. It's not very significant to the overall needle mover that we see in terms of market conditions. A lot of that's more on the domestic front.
And you mentioned on Argentina, but President Trump recently removed reciprocal tariffs on some beef products. Mm-hmm. You know, will the U.S. see more imports, or how could this affect U.S. prices for farmers and ranchers looking ahead?
It's a great thought. As we think about imports and we think about these tariffs, and all of us have had to become a lot more well-versed in tariffs in 2025, it's important to realize that the administration has used a couple different processes to administer tariffs to importing countries. And as we think of the removal last week of those reciprocal tariffs on beef items, specifically the one everybody's been watching is Brazil, because we know as of August, there's been a 50% tariff on Brazil imports into the United States. The removal of the reciprocal tariffs only removed 10 percentage points of that 50% tariff. So there's still an additional 40% tariff that's being applied on Brazil beef imports coming in based on what President Trump did in August. And so there's a 40% baseline tariff year-round right now on Brazil, unless something changes between now and publication time of this interview. And then there's also the fact that Brazil doesn't participate in a free trade agreement with the United States in regard to beef. And so their trade into the U.S. is classified under the other country's beef quota. What that means is essentially if you're not Australia, New Zealand, Argentina, Canada, Mexico, and maybe I'm missing one or two other smaller countries, you're lumped into all other countries. And that gives you the right to import the first 65,005 metric tons of beef into the U.S. tariff rate free. So then after that quota is met, and historically last year it was met on January 17th, or this year it was. Last year it was met in February. The year before that it was met in like May. Once that quota is hit, you get an extra 26.4% tariff applied to your beef imports. So the effective rate today for Brazilian imports into the U.S. is 66.4%. That doesn't materially change the import story for Brazil right now. That's still a very significant tax on product coming in. So does it move the needle from an import perspective? Perhaps, but our take on it is probably not materially.
Ag Secretary Brooke Rollins says that USDA is going to spend $100 million promoting American beef to consumers, and she says that that could help drive down beef prices. I mean, what kind of impact could that have, that marketing have, on cattle and beef prices?
Yeah, that spend is massive. It's unprecedented, right? And it's outside of like checkoff realm and things of that nature. And we're all very well familiar with beef checkoff and pork checkoff and soybean checkoff. That level of promotion is fascinating. And I think in light of not having a mandatory country of origin labeling law, where starting January 1, we're going to have a voluntary country of origin labeling law that producers will be able to participate in, the implementation of that law on January 1 with the additional $100 million of promotion is fascinating to see what that'll do to spur participation in that program. You know, a lot of, I should say, mandatory country of label ordering has become a political football in a lot of ways and somewhat creating unnecessary noise and strife in the industry. The voluntary program, I think, can eliminate a lot of that because the argument from the producers who want mandatory country of origin labeling is, there's extra dollars available for us by participating in that type of program. The naysayers say, well, there's not value in this, and that's why we quit doing it and didn't want it in the first place. Well, now if we have this voluntary program, and we think that there is demand for this product, and the government throws money at it to support that type of initiative, well, now we're gonna let the free market decide. And if it truly can bring additional dollars to the U.S. cattle producer, this is gonna be a great testing ground for that.
We'll be back with more from the National Association of Farm Broadcasting Convention right after this.
Trial lawyers are using a discredited report from a World Health Organization subagency to attack a safe, American-made weed-fighting tool. This critical tool helps keep your food costs down, and without it, food inflation could double. Stand with American farmers and keep trial lawyers' greed out of our farms and food supply. Fight back. Call your local representative.
Join us as we celebrate three decades of Commodity Classic, agriculture's largest farmer-led event, February 25th through 27th. Experience game-changing solutions. Connect with thousands of forward-thinking farmers and explore innovations from over 400 companies, all focused on powering your farm forward with efficiency and profitability. Housing and registration opens November 6th. Don't miss 30 years of agricultural excellence in the heart of Texas.
Welcome back. This administration and President Trump himself has embraced sugar as an alternative to high fructose corn syrup. We asked Luther Marquardt with the American Sugar Beet Growers Association what kind of impact that's had.
Well, there's little impact on the market. It's a kind of a niche product, and so we've always said that, you know, sugar is the gold standard for sweeteners. We're very proud of that. But the Coke issue is going to be probably fairly small, but we're thrilled that the president has recognized that.
Yeah, and lots of other things going on in farm country right now. It's maybe not the best time in the ag economy. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're hearing from your growers?
Sure. We just spoke with a lot of our growers just this past week, and it is very difficult on the farm right now. Most of our growers are not making any money on the crop this year, in fact losing significant amounts of money simply because there's too much sugar in the market. A lot of that sugar is being dumped by Brazil, and they're selling it below their cost of production, and they're some of the cheapest producers in the world. But the we have provided that information to USDA, and Deputy Secretary Vaden came to our symposium this summer, talked to growers. They are on top of it. They're deeply concerned, and we want to thank the Deputy and Secretary Rollins and even the President for looking at the situation and trying to see what we can do about it.
Yeah, Brazil is definitely the elephant in the room for a lot of the trade conversations right now.
Correct. They're the largest sugar producer in the world. They're the largest exporter. They have subsidies, and they dump. And when you're dumping below their cost of production, and that sugar's coming in and harming American farmers, that's not America producers being put first.
Maybe a bright spot is some sugar provisions were included in budget reconciliation earlier this summer, a big refresh on a lot of those programs. Can you walk us through what growers will see after that?
Sure. So in the budget reconciliation, we got stronger and historically strong increases in our loan rates. That is going to be helpful. That's good news for our producers. But most likely, we're not going to see market prices really any higher than that. So we're really still going to be at our cost of production. But we want to thank the committees, the chairs, the ranking members for helping us get this policy together. And that's going to be much more helpful for our producers.
We'll be back with more Newsmakers right after the break.
I think some of sustainability to farmers just comes second nature. If you asked a farmer, are you sustainable, they'd probably look at you maybe a little funny and say, I don't think I'm doing anything that special, but it really is just what they do. We're all farmers, and our goal is taking the best care of our land, our cattle, our natural resources.
This
is my sustainability story.
Regenerative poultry production is a process by which nature can actually recapture and restore the energy that is being taken out of a space.
Farm Credit helped Rahi build his dream of regenerative poultry farming and encouraging fellow immigrants to find community in agriculture.
Nothing beats a farm. I'm just pursuing happiness.
Learn more at farmcredit.com/beginning.
Check out our full lineup of Successful Farming podcasts. The Successful Farming podcast goes in-depth into the topics that affect farmers and ranchers. The 15 Minutes with a Farmer podcast offers a quick conversation between an editor and a farmer. The SF Shorts podcast offers bite-sized interviews about agricultural topics. And the SF Daily podcast covers commodity markets, weather, and the big things happening in agriculture each morning. Search for Successful Farming wherever you download your podcasts.
Welcome back. The U.S. saw a record fall harvest amid ongoing trade uncertainty. We asked Tanner Emke with CoBank's Knowledge Exchange what the U.S.-China trade deal means for agriculture.
It's been a positive so far, at first with China coming back to the market after having been away for so long. And the purchases that we've seen so far have been very encouraging. The run-up in soybean prices that we saw leading into these announced sales were probably China putting on hedges on flat price, and now they're finally securing freight and physical delivery. So now that's finally being materialized. The concern is, what does this ultimately look like from what's been announced previously? It's been announced they're going to buy 12 million metric tons. Details on that are hazy. You know, what does that look like over time? Can those purchases be switched to other locations, things like that. So a lot of uncertainty on what's been agreed to between the United States and China. A lot of those details still are missing, but the purchases that we've seen so far, I'd say are absolutely moving in the right direction. I would note those are probably politically made purchases, with Brazil offers being so much more competitive than U.S. offers.
China made a couple soybean purchases this week. You know, do you think that they can fulfill the commitments that they made in that trade deal, in that agreement? I mean, do you think that this week's purchases prove that that's possible?
It would be hard. given the window that we have between now and January 1st. They're clearly making an effort. The other issue, though, is you've got the Brazilian harvest coming online here in mid-January. So just not too far down the road, we're going to probably see another record harvest out of Brazil. And so the question is, what would be the incentive for China to pursue further purchases? Again, the ones that we're seeing right now are probably politically based. But if you really want to meet that 12 million metric ton commitment, or whatever has been agreed to, we're lacking on details there, Lydia. But if we were to meet 12 million tons, you're going to need to have those private crushers buying as well. And right now, it's not to their favor.
And you mentioned Brazil, but definitely the elephant in the room in the trade space right now. But
yes.
Do you see them as a long-term competitor for U.S. grain, or are they, really short-term right now, just benefiting from the trade tensions that the U.S. has more so created?
For soybeans, absolutely. They have millions and millions of acres in the Cerrado that they can still convert into row crop production. They're going to continue to add corn production, but at the same time, you have a rapidly expanding ethanol production space in Brazil. And so they're probably not going to be exporting corn. They're going to keep that at home. But on the soybean front, absolutely, they're going to be getting more competitive longer term.
And what does that mean for lots of U.S. farmers watching this right now? I mean, what does that mean? How should that shape their decision making going forward?
What it means then in this environment where you've got production capacity that's able to come online, not just in Brazil, but other countries around the world, like Kazakhstan, a country we don't hear about very often, but they're neighbors to China. They've got millions of acres that they can bring into production for other oil seeds like sunflower seed and canola, rapeseed. Canola's in Canada. What this means for the farmer is that what we've always known, high prices in a commodity market don't stick around for very long. And so when the market does offer a profitable price, that window is not going to be open for very long. So farmers have to be nimble.
We'll be back with more Newsmakers right after this.
Trial lawyers are using a discredited report from a World Health Organization subagency to attack a safe, American-made weed-fighting tool. This critical tool helps keep your food costs down, and without it, food inflation could double. Stand with American farmers and keep trial lawyers' greed out of our farms and food supply. Fight back. Call your local representative.
Join us as we celebrate three decades of Commodity Classic, agriculture's largest farmer-led event, February 25th through 27th. Experience game-changing solutions. Connect with thousands of forward-thinking farmers and explore innovations from over 400 companies, all focused on powering your farm forward with efficiency and profitability. Housing and registration opens November 6th. Don't miss 30 years of agricultural excellence in the heart of Texas.
Successful Farming presents the 15 Minutes with a Farmer podcast. In each episode, a successful farming editor has a quick conversation with a farmer, chock full of stories and advice from their area of agriculture. They're interesting, educational, and perfect for your busy schedule. Search for 15 Minutes with a Farmer wherever you download your podcasts.
Welcome back. Numerous crop insurance provisions were included in President Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill passed over the summer. We asked Tom Zacharias with the National Crop Insurance Services how growers will feel the impact of those policy changes.
I think the major two components of that for growers will be the increases in premium support for individual coverages, and then the increased premium support for the supplemental products, and those products fit above the deductible. So it really enhances the coverage opportunities for our farmers.
The longest government shutdown in the country's history recently ended. Can you tell us about what some of your agents did during the shutdown? I mean, they were able to keep working even though many of the programs at USDA and facilitation of those was paused.
Right. Given the structure of the crop insurance program and the interrelationship with USDA, companies were able to operate, agents as well in terms of servicing policies, adjusters out in the field adjusting claims. And at a time like this with stress in the farm community, economics not great at all, The ability for crop insurance to be there to service the risk management needs is huge. And I think it speaks to the strength of the system that we have here in the U.S. We've had several shutdowns in the past. Companies are able to operate, keep the process going. And then in terms when we're back up to speed, going back to the OB3, get ready to implement the provisions of that, which will improve the risk management options for the farmers. So it speaks to, for crop insurance, the public-private partnership, the benefits that we have here, and that the companies are able to work with USDA on getting this business processed, and farmers can rely on crop insurance. We've got, what, over 400 million acres insured across the country. Coverage levels are already at 70% or above, so with OB3 we should see some uptick there. And then also the ability to cover more of their costs with the supplemental products. So we're looking forward to 2026.
Yeah, and USDA will soon begin rolling out stage two of the Supplemental Disaster Relief Program. I mean, what's broadly at stake there for farmers, and how do your agents, how are they involved with rolling out this program?
It's our understanding as this rolls out that there will be some training done for the agents so they're not caught unawares. And it's been our experience that agents are pretty razor sharp on the issues of other farm programs outside crop insurance. And farmers rely on that agency force to make sure those coverages are aligned and understanding what's available with those disaster programs.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of AgriPulse Newsmakers. Tune in next week and check our website anytime for the latest developments in all things food, farm, and fuel policy. For AgriPulse, I'm Lydia Johnson. Thanks for watching.
Newsmakers is a production of AgriPulse Communications. You can also find our new content on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to follow AgriPulse and our correspondents on social media to get breaking news and more. For agriculture, trade, food, environment, and regulatory news, your source is AgriPulse.com.